If you've ever wanted a peek into how rich people handle their money, this is it. Because of course, there's the public face, the society pages, the business write-ups, maybe even the Instagram posts. But underneath that, there's usually a highly calculated money strategy. And what surprised me is how much of that strategy can be copied by regular people too. But don't take my word for it, because today we're talking to someone who's been on the inside of those high-level money conversations for years. Andrew Clements is a private wealth and succession lawyer. He works with some of New Zealand's wealthiest families, helping them protect their money, grow it, and make sure it doesn't get derailed by one bad decision.
All the wealthy and ultra high net worths that I've dealt with understand you've got part of life is going to be about generating wealth. It's going to have risk associated with it, right? Then the other part is about how do you steward it and protect it.
And once you hear how these families actually manage their money, might not be what you expect. The investments they choose, the way they make them, is so different from what TV or movies might have you believe.
A mistake that I made early on is, oh my gosh, the property market's going up, I must buy a house. Whereas the high wealth and the ultra high net worth are going, oh my gosh, property market's going up, we shall sell.
And then there's the stuff that they work hard to make sure stays private, out of the headlines, but still has a really big impact. The tight inner circles, the guardrails wealthy families put around themselves, and yes, the big mistakes that still happen when someone gets it wrong.
And they both sat there and said, how do we ensure this doesn't become poison? And they were really serious with that question.
So, welcome to Making Sense. It's the podcast for people who want financial freedom without giving up their coffee. I'm Frances Cook, a financial journalist and fellow financial freedom seeker who makes money simple for you. And today we're going behind the scenes of how wealthy families really build and protect their money and the surprising lessons the rest of us can steal for our own money lives. Andrew Clements, welcome to Making Sense. So lovely to have you here. Now, you have a very interesting job. You work in private wealth and succession, which from my research means you work with some very rich people and help them organize their lives, protect themselves, make sure that they're looking after their money in the right way. Starters, I didn't really know that this was an area you could get into. How did you get into this area?
Yeah, hey, thanks, Frances. Thanks for having me. It is a fun area, you know. And the whole reason I got into the area is, I think, a little bit similar to why you're passionate about what you do. And that is, I was really passionate about how do we take learnings from what successful families have done and help the mum and dad Kiwi understand it, and how can we translate that down to something that works and helps them. And interestingly, through that process, I got to know a few families, you know, high net worth and ultra high net worth families, and have been privileged to work with them. And it's been interesting because, they're quite different to how you'd think.
When we're talking high net worth and ultra high net worth, what are we talking here, ballpark?
So ballpark, minimum for high net worth is to have $50 million available for investments, and ultra high net worth is more north of $100 US.
Wow.
So quite significant. And it's amazing how many families are, and you'd never know.
Go on. Are they the sort of people that you could walk past them on the street and you wouldn't know?
Correct. What I learned early on in the process, Frances, is the difference between people that have money and people that are wealthy is largely to do not just with the numbers in their bank account, but it's to do with their mindset and their values. And so the saying that a friend of mine gave me early on in this journey is, he said, money talks, but wealth whispers. And I didn't really appreciate until I started on this journey the significance of that statement, but it is huge.
How have you seen that play out in real life when you're talking to clients? What are some of these wealth whispers?
What I've come to understand is that a wealthy family, they're not short on financial resource. So their highest priority is, in fact, family, values, and relationships. You know, a relationship and an advisor that they can trust and rely on is more of greater value to them than making $100,000.
It's interesting that, isn't it? Because there's that saying that money doesn't make you happy, which I myself strongly disagree with. I think it's very hard to be happy if you are broke. And there's this issue with the way I've sort of framed it as I've thought about this a bit more over the years. I feel like money can take away a lot of problems, can take away a lot of the negatives. And then you have to build the positives yourself, but it gives you the space to build those positives. So I so agree with what you say there in terms of when you talk to these people who are very wealthy, have a lot of resources at their disposal, the ones who are trying to live a good life, trying to live a happy life, are often then very focused on the people, because that's what, when you take away the money worries, that's what actually makes people happy, right?
Correct. That's exactly right. The difference between a successful outcome and a failure is often based on the person's values. And it's sort of like when I was doing some MBA work, we looked at this whole concept of leadership. And the example there was, is leadership moral or amoral? Right. And it's very easy to sort of conclude at one level that it's amoral. And you can get examples of some horrendous leaders in history and so forth. But when you peel it back, it's going, only moral leadership endures. Amoral leadership may be effective for a short period of time. It might have some successes. And when you and I look to the financial space, you can see people that seem to have all the successes, the trappings of wealth. They're going great guns and making oodles of money. And you wouldn't want them as your best friend. And then sure enough, within a very short time, they're in disgrace. They're in the press. They're in court. They're in jail. You know, whereas the ones that don't have that value set or that moral code have a stronger moral compass. I'm not saying saints, but I'm just saying people that are actually clear about who they are and what their values are and that they live according to that. They're the ones that endure and last.
Isn't it funny? Because this comes up in all sorts of areas of money. And I spend far too much time on social media. So I get some interesting comments sometimes with, people saying things like, I don't care. I just want to make the most money possible. And I get that.
Can understand it, but
we've all got to make a crust in this life. But if you really want to take the cynical view, then actually exactly what you just said, I strongly believe, and you see this in the data, even in things like ethical investing, that you can often short-term make some money taking shortcuts, not having that sort of point of view of trying to do the right thing, do the wrong thing all the time, but not necessarily deliberately, you know?
Correct, yeah. Unintentional is different to I'm going out to try and, yeah.
Yeah, and when you do intentionally go out and try to do the wrong things to make a quick buck, it's so often, just give it enough time, it backfires. What is it? The trash takes itself out.
It's a good one.
So when you're dealing with some of these people who are high net worth, ultra high net worth, is there a common way that they have built up their assets, a common tactic?
A common theme amongst all of them is they play the long game. Not only that, but they work or they think in almost two spaces simultaneously. And so if you think, a good example is our brain. So we've got a left hemisphere, a right hemisphere, and we've got that little cerebral cortex that matches it. And depending whether you're asking my wife whether I, we get to use 3% of that at the time or not, but on a good day I'll claim 3%. And part of life is risk. It's about making money, generating money. But the thinking and the understanding around that is completely different to how you retain and steward it. And so it's sort of like a left brain, right brain. And it's sort of an analogy we used when we were working with young clients setting up, going, how do we get our mindset right on this? It's to understand you've got part of life is going to be about generating wealth. It's going to have risk associated with it, right? And the other part is about how do you steward it and protect it. But thematically through both those hemispheres, all the wealthy and ultra high net worths that I've dealt with have this long game mentality where they're going, yeah, we don't burn our friends to make a quick buck because we're focused on the long game. And if we don't make a great return today, don't worry, we'll do it tomorrow. And I met a really remarkable young guy and his was unique circumstances, but the reason I'll tell the story is it gives you the mindset behind him. So he was in this unique situation. He was from Lithuania and the wall had come down in Germany and there was just this release of democracy. And he had a friend of his in a country further to the right on the map. And they were starving. And his country had this problem where they had all these beef farms, and beef farmers couldn't sell any of their product. And they had, and what was worse is they had no vehicles. They couldn't drive and get anything to market. They couldn't drive and get their supplies and from the stores, all these sorts of issues. So he did a deal with his mate's country where he sold all the beef to them. And they were broke. And they said, "We can't pay for it." He said, "That's fine. You've got all these cars sitting around that you can't sell. Pay us with cars." So they sent an entire train loads of cars back to pay for this beef. He then, of course, then offloaded them all these Western countries that were saying, "Hey, it's really funky to buy these cars that aren't being manufactured anymore." And that's and I said, "And that's where you got paid." And he said, "No, because there was another problem in my country, which was timber." And so he did three different kinds of products in three different cycles, and then he banked it. And I looked at him and I thought, "And that's why you're worth north of 50 million.
Mm-hmm. An absolute problem solver.
Yep. And he didn't get greedy. And that's the other thing. He didn't get greedy. He took enough to manage cash flow and keep everything going. But he was, as you said, he was a problem solver. And he won the long game.
Tell me more about didn't get greedy as well, because I do think that's a bit of a tricky one where you often hear that one of the most dangerous times in a business is when they're doing well. Because you start making all this money, you start trying to expand, but then you also will have all of these extra costs. And it can be a bit of a house of cards situation where one thing goes wrong, you get a cascade effect in this business that could have been amazing, just done. So was that sort of, when you're saying he didn't get greedy, was that the sort of thing he was avoiding?
100% avoiding that. And instead of going, "Hey, I'm so successful, look at me, I'm wonderful, I'm going to take more out of it." Mm-hmm. He didn't. He kept to what he knew worked, and he made sure that everybody in the process made out of it. So there were no losers in that, and that's why he did so well, because no one knifed him in the back either.
Truly is so much about relationships. I think your point earlier as well about when you were saying about it's one thing to make the wealth, another thing to safeguard it. And this kind of leads into a point that I'm really passionate on, where people often will ask me, what's the best investment? And now I love the share market. I am definitely a share market girly, but that's not my answer. It's your earning power to me. And I'm very open to you disagreeing with that. But I think your first investment should be into your earning power, whether that's education, whether that's building a business. You can't do anything until you've got money to do it with. And investing is so important to then keep it growing so that you're not working every day for the rest of your life. But, you know, you have to earn that money first and then put it to work. So when you deal with some of these clients, is that, you know, are they people who've launched businesses or things like that? How do they build it up?
In every single case, it's launched businesses. But what's kind of fun is some of them, not until they're older, you've got to invest in you. You know, we are our greatest asset. If we're not equipped to achieve and reach our potential, we never can. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, part of that's just making sure that we continue to learn, have an attitude of lifelong learning, and the power of your network and your friends. You know, just making sure you've got good people in your life that speak into you, that you're open to if you're going doing something wrong, that you know that they'll come to you with the right motivation and say, "Hey, Francis, don't go there."
it's so important.
It is. It's so important. It is. And it's amazing how that kind of worked. And one example I'm thinking of, that's precisely what happened. He'd invested in education. He'd come from an incredibly humble background, really humble background, and worked his way up. Educated himself, trained, learned, lifelong learner. And then when he was older in life and had been successful in his traditional career, he noticed a young guy who was just really struggling. And he took him aside and said, "Why are you struggling? Oh, I'm so sorry. No, I'm not criticizing you. I'm concerned for you." And the guy realized he's authentic, and he unloaded his dream that he had for this business and how he's working on developing all the infrastructure for that business in his own time. And this guy I know went away and did a bit of research on the business sector and thought, far out, this is actually really big. And so he said, look, I'm in a position now where I can actually pivot in my career. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to pivot and I'm going to invest in you. Wow. And the interesting thing is, and they went on quite a journey, which we can talk about another day, but now, suffice to say, my friend is solidly in the ultra high net worth category, courtesy of taking the time to have some empathy for this guy and to invest in him. But he could only do that because he'd invested in himself, educated himself, been through those schools of hard knocks, learned along the road, and had built good friends and good connections.
This might be a personal bias because I only started my own business in my mid to late 30s. But I really like what you say about a lot of people later in life, because it's very common. You know, you have the 30 under 30 and all of these things, and it's exciting and inspiring. And I love those stories about people in their 20s who had an amazing idea and made it happen. And you see some of these Young Entrepreneur of the Year awards, and they are genuinely inspiring, and I love it. But I think because they're such interesting stories, it can then sometimes make the rest of us be like, oh, missed the boat.
I'm such an underachiever.
Yeah. So I guess I'll just slog my guts out until I'm done.
Yeah.
But it's, whereas when I look at my, I mean, to some people would still think that starting my own business mid-30s is quite young, to which those people I say bless and thank you.
That's right.
But, you know, I spent my 20s working incredibly hard for very little money in an industry that was always not going to pay me very much. Media world, not noted for the great pay scales unless you become Mike Hosking, and that wasn't going to be me. And so it's, you know, it's a tough industry, but I learned so many skills and I tried so many different areas of the business, bounced around, built up this really wide range of skills, hit mid-30s and said, time to do some things differently, built something all of my own that is much more powerful in terms of the income side of things, but I could never have done it without that 15 years build up.
It's that school of life, isn't it? Yes. That you can't underestimate how powerful that is. So often we think if I'm not a multimillionaire by 28, the world's going to end.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's not.
Yeah, exactly.
I can say one thing. No, it's not. You know, all you're doing is learning. You know, you look at so many ultra high net worths, they didn't make their money in their youth. It's so rare. I mean, I've got one. Out of my entire client base, I've got one. You know, mid-30s is perfect age to start, you know. You've got enough experience, but you've got enough energy, youth, and vision to really do it. And it's great.
Say youth again. Thank you. I spend far too much time around people in their young 30s / late 20s, and I'm sitting there going, is it time for Botox yet? I don't know.
Not a chance. I'm sitting here with 8 grandkids going, I can't talk.
And so when you've got these people who have, as you say, for the vast majority of them, launched businesses, I mean, that is an incredible way to build income. Then they're looking at ways to diversify, protect it, make it go to work so that they don't have to for the rest of their lives. So investments. Are there particular types of investments that they tend to favour? And are they open to the rest of us?
100%. And that's a brilliant question because so often we think, oh, it's all right for them because they're ultra wealthy. But the reality is all they're doing is the same thing we're doing. The only differential is numbers. And yes, at some level, there are some contract options that aren't available to us, but they're ultra risky ones. Okay. And I don't think that you and I would want to play with them unless we could lose a million or two.
Yeah. I'm not there yet.
Not there yet, right? One day maybe. But,
I'd love to be there.
Exactly. What you'll get there, Francis. I have every confidence in you achieving that. But for the most part, it's really long, again, it's driven by this long game thinking. So what they tend to do is they tend to build good relationships with good advisors, people that share their values and their understanding. And there's a saying that we have in our practice, which every young staff member can recite in their sleep, and that is philosophy breeds methodology. Right. And so what that means is when someone comes in to see me or to see one of our staff, you don't sit there and go, hey, great, Francis, it's so wonderful to meet you. I know you want to get ahead in life. Here's something we did for the last person.
Gotcha.
Right. Take the time to understand Francis, who she is, you know, her vision, her passion, her drive, the fact that she's got this real energy, this can-do attitude and this and vision and the courage to step out and do something about it, and then map something around that. Don't fit her into the mold from someone else. Understand the concepts behind it, and the concepts are all invariably encourage you to have a long game mindset, and then get some good people that are going to support her. And it might be that she starts learning by playing with something like Sheezies or something like that, you know. And that's all about learning. It's what we talked about earlier. It's about giving yourself that understanding around financial literacy. How does this work? But it's really good to have a good advisor or two that you can trust, who understands your values. It isn't going to try and put you into things that you don't believe in or can't stomach. But they're going to understand how you're wired and what your views are, and then they can come up with plans that work on that. And Shares is great, you know. It's anything that's going to build earning power across time.
I think that's really important, though, some of the things you mentioned there, because I've got a previous podcast where I talked about, you know, how to find a financial advisor that works. And the big thing that I think you need to start with is I always suggest have a short list of people that you think could be good. Go and make that initial meeting, but you want to check if they're actually listening to you as a person, because money is not just, you know, building up money. You sit on it like a dragon. You're like, well done, I've got all this money, yay me. You know, that's not, well, I mean, it's a great game, but that's not the game to my mind. To me, it's what do you want out of life? How do you build backwards from there? And that might mean a totally different strategy from what is the correct strategy compared to someone else. So do you find that, you know, when you're talking to these people and you're looking at what do they want from life, what do they value, you can end up with quite different financial plans?
100%. I can't think of any two that are identical in what, a 30-year career?
One thing that I often think about, though, right, is in terms of when they do start making those plans, I've noticed, and I'd love to know if this matches your experience, because mine is just coming from conversations here and there with people. People only open up so much to me. And I'm imagining they get real into the weeds with you by necessity. So I've noticed that there is sort of broadly in New Zealand quite an obsession with property. And when I talk to people who are in that higher net worth, it's not, they don't have a problem with property necessarily, and they might have some property holdings. More of them seem to be more interested in things like the share market and stocks and those sorts of assets. What's been your experience in terms of if they favour any sort of particular assets and particular strategies?
Yep. Bear in mind that I'm not a financial advisor, but we are talking about observations. And what I find is that if we move out of the wealth generation zone of their life across to the safety and the stewardship zone of their life, they will tend to favour things like shares, metals, and mixtures of properties. A mistake that I made early on is, oh my gosh, the property market's going up, I must buy a house. Whereas the high wealth and the ultra high net are going, oh my gosh, property market's going up, we shall sell.
Gotcha.
And they see investments a bit like you and I see product at the produce at the supermarket. When they walk in, they go, what's on special today? You know what I'm saying? Oh, the tomatoes are no longer red gold this week. They're down to a reasonable price. We shall buy some of those.
Yeah. Put them on the, yeah, the windowsill. They'll right. ripen up. They'll It'll ripen be great. Up
and away we go. Exactly. Exactly. So you're correct. They do have a blend. And depending on the level, whether that's a blend within New Zealand or a blend across jurisdictions too.
Yes. How much do they? Because I was actually just having a conversation about this the other day, the idea of the home country bias. Because that is something a lot of people get stuck in when they're investing. And it's another thing that sort of mildly puts me off property. Again, I'm not saying property is a bad investment. Property can be great. But it's you do often tend to buy not only in your home country, but in your home city, which can leave you with a very localized investment, very, you know, limited in that way. Whereas this is one of the reasons why I like the share market for the average person. It makes it so much easier to go international, spread a bit of that risk.
Yeah, it's so, accessibility, isn't it?
Yeah. So with your clients, they're looking overseas as well?
100%. And so like you and I and most of my clients who are starting the journey, investments and equities are a great way because you're not just limited to the local markets. And the nice thing is you're not just thinking, oh, I love that street down there. You know what I'm saying? You're thinking, what's actually going to generate a return? And that's the important thing.
When you are working with these people, you mentioned right at the beginning that a lot of wealthy people aren't what you would expect.
Yes.
But when you first started getting into this area, was there anything that did surprise you, anything that you think would surprise other people now about what these people are like and how they operate in the world?
There were a few surprises. People who you thought were very, very wealthy, and we got to know them, you realise they were just very flashy, great at spending. And as life's gone on, their net worth has diminished. And because of their earlier decisions and their values, sadly for them, life is sort of fraying for them. Some of the very wealthy ones that I've worked with have been the opposite. And I can remember, I really take my head off to two of these clients, and they both sat there and said, how do we ensure this doesn't become poison? And they were really serious with that question. And they're going, we've built a lot of resource and we're continuing to build resource. You know, we're not dead and retired yet, but how do we make sure it doesn't become poison? And I thought that question alone signaled to me where their values were at. And I thought, you guys are going to be phenomenal. And they continue to be, and they continue to impress me at every turn. The higher I've gone up the wealth chain there, the stronger has been the question of going, if we're going to make an investment, we want to know how it's going to help. In fact, these families will often say to the advisors, don't even present an investment opportunity unless it comes with a report on how it's going to help the community. And so the whole concept of impact investing is really, really strong.
Tell me a bit more about what impact investing is and how much you see that come up with your clients.
To me, impact investing is probably not the technically correct definition, but it's where you invest with a view to having a constructive impact in the community and in the areas that you want to support. And so I think it's really exciting because I'm seeing people go, we want to have this impact investing strategy. We want good returns, but we want it to help as well. Impact investment is where we've got enough resource, right? If all I did is just stuck every coin I have in the bank, I'm not going to run out of it. So how do I then use it as a tool for good? I've got to be responsible and keep growing it because otherwise inflation will eat it. And I've got future generations to consider and I've got a duty of care to them. But how do I do it in a way that's actually going to help others? It's not just going to benefit myself, but it's going to benefit others. And that I didn't expect to see as strong as it is. And it's encouraging to see that it's actually becoming stronger as these families are saying, hey, we've got a duty of care to our community, not just to ourselves.
I wonder, the flip side of some of what we've been talking about, though, is I wonder, do you ever have people come to you who are feeling a bit stressed? Because I can quite imagine getting into a position where we all come from different spots in life, but especially if someone's come from not having anywhere near as much, built up a lot, and then you have all of this cash, you've had a taste of the good life.
Yes, yeah.
It's quite fun, the things you can do when you've got money.
Exactly, quite rewarding. And as you say, you've got resource to do what you're passionate about.
Yeah. Right?
Don't want to lose that.
Exactly. So you now have this idea of what you could miss out on if it all goes away. So do you ever have people come to you quite stressed? And how do you start by dealing with that? As you say, move from the building to preserving.
Increasingly, that's the conversation I'm having with people. And risk is a big fear. They're going, hey, we've been successful, we've done well, but we don't want to lose all of this. And that's really where that client's coming, saying, how do I make sure this doesn't become poison? Because we're all really great as advisors of going, oh, you've got to watch out for tax risk. We've got to watch out for market risk. We've got to watch out for professional risk. We've got to watch out for business risk. But increasingly, I'm having people come and go, what about family risk? You know, it's the internal destruction, the internal liabilities that people often miss.
When you say family risk, do you mean in terms of people in the family maybe exploiting something, or like power dynamics, or not being able to pass money along when you wanted it to? You know, what are we talking with the family risk?
Every single one of those.
Okay. So there's many.
Yes, there's many, many risks, but fundamentally it's about where families implode or destruct. And that can just destroy wealth so fast, it's just not even funny.
How do you protect against that then?
Oh, yeah.
With difficulty.
With intention. You know, the reality is we all have strategy and design in terms of how we live. The difference is we either do it by design or by default. It's a bit like companies. You know, a business can create a culture by design, or if you don't, it's going to have a culture. It just might not be very good, but it'll have one, whether you design it or not. So design something you want. And it's the same thing for this. You know, there's so many risks that it's worthwhile sitting down and going, right, philosophy breeds methodology. What are your values? What are your priorities? And then let's code the solutions around that. And there are always strategies and there are always solutions. And the earlier you start this process and this conversation, the better. That's the one thing that I encourage every person that's on this journey, is to think about that sorts of things earlier on and plan earlier on. You know, too often you're having these conversations around a courtroom because they left it too late. And that to me is tragic, because then you're wasting a lot of money on someone like myself when you could actually be doing something constructive with it.
Mm-hmm.
Not that paying your lawyers a bad thing. God bless you, those who do.
Thank you very much. But
long may you continue.
Not needed at all. Yeah.
But hopefully we do, because we're helping you grow rather than dealing with the implosion.
Are there strategies that can, like, I imagine it's so horses for courses and so individualized, but are there some sort of broader strategies that can work in many situations?
Yes, there are. And that's where we kind of help clients understand the two spheres, you know, the risk sphere and the safe zone sphere, as you like. And so that's where you step across on that safe zone and say, how are we going to hold these assets? What controls are we going to have around that? And who do we let into those places of control? And they're really, really important questions. Now, we've got traditionally you'd use trusts in that space quite a bit. In recent times, we used different sorts of structures as well. So we've used a Jersey trust in one context, not for tax purposes. We registered it as a New Zealand taxpayer. But the reason we used Jersey was they don't have a 125-year limit.
Huh.
You see, and that's a big problem when you're planning long game stuff for these people. They've got to think beyond three generations.
There's that classic saying that money is often lost within three generations. You know, first generation makes it. Second generation, at best, keeps it. Third generation loses it. Do you think that's true?
I think that that's globally true, but I don't think that's something that we have to be bound by. And I've seen many families successfully beat that and beat it really well.
How?
By design. Instead of leaving things to default and instead of leaving things late, they start early. And they start, interestingly, with what we talked about at the beginning, this a discussion around values. And then that allows them to set expectations, and then they can design things around that. And families that do that, I'm working with one internationally where they've transitioned from generation 11 to generation 12. Per capita, they grow minimum of double generation on generation. And so their financial resources outpacing their biological family growth on a per capita basis.
Wow.
And that's not uncommon.
So, like you say, you're starting there on the values and the expectations. So is that in terms of trying to instill a work ethic in the kids, or like how do you do that? Because it's so mixed. A lot of people want to leave a lot of money to their children. I think that can be very dangerous strategy. Having a bunch of money dumped on you young can actually ruin your finances. But like, are they saying, well, then you're on your own, kid? Or, you know, what's the various strategies there as you're trying to help them navigate the world to not lose the amazing resources they were born into?
You just highlighted something really important, and that is, in the absence of good strategy and training and preparation, you're dealing with a lot of effect. You know, you see it, Francis, when you're doing research, right? That if you lined up 100 first division lottery winners, probably 98% are financially worse off than before they won lotto, because they just can't. You're not prepared for it, and so that's exactly what it is. They're not prepared for it. So you've got to prepare those ears for it. You know, UBS Bank released a paper last year, and they interviewed the top 200 wealthiest families that they had, you know, and figures that we can only dream of, right? And interestingly enough, they looked at the top 10 things that made a difference for them. And a friend of mine who's doing their master's in neuroscience out of London said, cognitively, people will live with it. They'll live to the top 10 values or priorities, and they will adhere to the top 7. They had planning and values as the lowest it got was number 6. But the other interesting thing was that generation on generation, less than 40% of the next generation were involved in the same sector, let alone the same business as the previous generation. And it's an interesting stat to consider, because when you and I are talking with people go, oh yeah, that's all right for them because they've got this cornerstone business, right? But we don't. But we've got this resource. And that's exactly what you're drawing out here, Francis, is it doesn't have to be that you have a cornerstone successful business. You know, we're not all going to be farmers or Gallagher's or Enron, you know, but we might have resource and been very effective at it. And it's how you pass that resource to that forward. It's the planning, it's the training, it's the preparing. That's when people then receive that mantle of stewardship, and they've been set up for success rather than being set up for failure. You can be fun. It doesn't have to all be serious. It can be quite fun. One of the most fun examples was a young couple, and they had I think they were a 7-year-old and a 5-year-old. And so they sat them around the dinner table, and they put a $100 note on the table. These kids' eyes, you know, big pancakes. Whoa, there's gold, there's a lot of lollies. And mum and dad said, who are we giving it to? Oh, it's not for us. Nope. And so every month they sat the kids around the table and they discussed who they would give it to. And over years, these kids became quite passionate about different charities, supporting their local school and helping with orphanages and food soup kitchens and so forth. And the mum and dad made it not just that they gave, but they actually gave their time. So if you're passionate about something, you got to do it. And then after time, the kids came to mum and dad, and I've had this in many years' time from now, Francis, you might have it with yours. And they said to them, mum and dad, you're a bit tight. Mum and dad look at them and said, you're right. Now, I don't know if you remember, it wasn't that long ago you were a teenager. For me, it was quite a while ago. But I can remember saying something contentious to my parents and them agreeing with me and make me really nervous. It's like, what am I missing here, right? And so these kids are looking really nervous. What are we missing? And the mum and dad go, well, what are you going to do about it? Right? Because all your life, we've been putting $100 on the table per month and giving it away. What are you going to do about it? Don't just look to us. You know, you're adulting now. Yeah, that horrible term. You're adulting now. What are you guys going to do? You need to step up to the plate. And so they said, well, we could do this. And they talked a whole lot of fundraisers and stuff. And mum and dad said, yep, all good things. But we've got this family enterprise. And there's this division that you're really good at. And if you grew that by 10%, it's not $100 a month we're putting on the table. It's 1,000. And they said to the daughter, I think it was, now you answer this question, what's it mean to your charity to start the year knowing they got 12 grand every year for the rest of your life? And she got involved and she did that. And the question I ask people, clients, is what drove her to take on that part of the family business? Was it what's in it for me? Well, it kind of was, in that those values were for her, but really it was about the impact she could make. Successful, phenomenally successful businesswoman right now. She runs a multi-billion-dollar division and is just phenomenal person, absolutely phenomenal. But it started from mum and dad preparing her for that mindset. The other thing she didn't realise until she was into running that division is that all those years sitting around the table, she learned what governance was. Because when you think about it, that's what it was. They were sitting around the table, engaging conversation, how do we achieve strategic objective? And taught her to deal with differing opinions and different power dynamics, because, you know, mum and dad are higher than her, but she was able to take a leadership role regardless of where she sat in that rank. And she was able to manage and govern.
It's such a good story because it links to so many things that we can talk about, but can feel a bit abstract until you get a really good example like that. It's connecting the money to the values, to the goals, to something you actually care about, because money is always emotional and you never do something just because you should. It has to connect. So it's connecting the money to those values and goals. And then when they're wanting more, great. What are you going to do about it?
Exactly. You know? How are you going to step up?
Yeah. And giving them that push to, you know, don't just ask other people to do things for you. Figure this out. What is your solution and how are you going to carry it out? And that's really empowering for kids, I think. A lot of the time we think we're helping kids by doing something for them or whatever. And okay, they do need a lot of that when they're very young. It's hard to remember as they get older. They don't as much. And by doing things for them, you can actually take the fun away. You can take the empowerment away. By being like, what are you going to do? I think is such just an important sentence in itself. What are you going to do now?
Correct. Yeah. So how are you going to help?
So if someone came to you and they'd heard the type of clients that you have and they said, look, I'm an average person. I'm on the average wage. I would like to become financially independent. I would like to achieve some of these, you know, financial heights that some of your clients have. First of all, do you think it's possible for someone coming from that sort of average situation? And secondly, like, what are some steps they would need to take?
The answer is yes, I do believe it. And there was a time when I've said no to that. But having dealt now with a number of clients that when they grew up were so poor and yet are worth hundreds of millions, you go, it has to be. Because I'm dealing with real life people who've done it, right? And in every single case, they have started by investing in their own learning. They have taken the time to develop and to improve their own financial literacy. You know, someone once said to me that the difference between having financial literacy and not having financial literacy when it comes to investment is the difference between investing and gambling. And I think that's true. You know, the combination, the synergy of being wiser with what they've had, building good relationships, building their own financial literacy and knowledge, meant that when they come across an opportunity, they're able to take it. I can't remember who it was, Louis Pasteur or someone who said, chance favours the prepared mind. And that's really what I encourage young ones to do, saying, can I do that? And my answer is, yes, you can. You know, and if you do all that and you don't end up a multi-billionaire, don't panic, because you'll end up achieving more than what you ever could have thought or imagined, and you'll be happy, you know, because you become the best you. And that's what it's all about.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so funny, isn't it? Because sometimes I'll talk about mindset things and investing in knowledge and that, and I think it can sound really fluffy. I so get that. But I think it's not just getting opportunities in life. Yes, getting the opportunity is sometimes really hard, getting that break. But it also can be easy to not see the opportunity when they turn up because you don't know what you're looking for and you don't know how to make the most of it. And so even if an opportunity turns up and you don't know, A, that it is an opportunity, B, how to turn it into something, you're going to be stuffed and you might miss so many things without even realizing, right? You've given me so much food for thought today. Andrew Cummins, thank you so much for coming on Making Sense. I've really, really enjoyed this chat.
You've been wonderful, Frances. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. And if you've enjoyed this chat, of course, send it to a friend too so we can all level up our money together. Hit subscribe to Making Sense wherever you're listening, Spotify, YouTube, Apple Podcasts. Just make sure you hit that subscribe button on your way out. Until next time, have a great day.
Just a note before you go. This podcast can only give you general information about how things work in most cases. It's not individual financial advice. We're all different, so some of this might not apply to your specific situation. Take what works for you, ignore the rest. If you're after individual financial advice, a financial advisor is always the best bet.